My name is Avram Kallis, and I've spent the last 8 years carving out a blood-soaked existence in the bowels of Nostromo Secundus. The perpetual darkness here isn't just an absence of light, it's a living thing that crawls into your bones and makes its home there. The artificial luminators mounted on rusted brackets cast their sickly yellow glow through air, so thick with industrial smog that breathing feels like drowning in slow motion. Chemical particulates from the processing plants coat everything in a grimy film that never washes clean, and the stench of sulfur and burnt promethium hangs so heavy you can taste it on your tongue hours after leaving the worst sectors. I work as a mid-tier enforcer for the Crimson Talon Gang, which means I'm the kind of man mothers warn their sons about becoming, assuming they live long enough to offer such warnings. My territory spans the festering maze of Sector Quintanus, where corroded hab blocks lean against each other like drunken corpses, their foundations eaten away by decades of acid rain and neglect. The buildings here weren't designed to last, they were thrown up quick and cheap during the Great Industrial Expansion, when the planetary governors still believed Nostromo had a future worth investing in. Now they're monuments to decay, their walls streaked with rust stains that look disturbingly like dried blood in the amber light. The industrial waste processing facilities dominate the sector's eastern quadrant, massive concrete structures that churn and groan day and night, processing the toxic runoff from the upper hive's manufactorums. The chemical stench that pours from their exhaust stacks mingles with the smell of human decay in ways that would make a seasoned mortician wretch. Bodies don't disappear on Nostromo, they just become part of the landscape, rotting in alleyways and abandoned hab units until the rats and the chemicals reduce them to stains on the rockcrete. I learned early that survival here depends on understanding the hierarchy, and the Crimson Talons have a structure as rigid as any Imperial Guard regiment, though considerably more creative in its brutality. At the bottom are the runners, desperate fools who carry messages and small packages, usually lasting about 3 months before they're found face down in a drainage canal. Above them are the street soldiers, the muscle who handle the basic intimidation work. I climbed past that level 5 years ago when I demonstrated a particular talent for extracting information from uncooperative merchants. My current position puts me in charge of tribute collection across 17 city blocks, a responsibility that requires equal parts violence and psychology. The merchants who operate in our territory understand the arrangement, they pay their weekly tribute, and we ensure their shops don't burn down in mysterious fires. The factory workers are a different matter entirely. They barely scrape together enough thrones to feed their families, but fear is a currency that spends just as well as coin, and a broken arm sends a message that resonates through entire hab blocks. The collection routes I work follow patterns established through years of blood and intimidation. Every second day, I make the rounds through the commercial district where vendors sell questionable meat and recycled clothing from stalls that look ready to collapse at any moment. The merchants there have learned to have their tribute ready before I arrive, counting out worn coins with trembling fingers while avoiding eye contact. Their fear has a particular smell, sharp and acidic, cutting through even the omnipresent chemical reek of the sector. The factory district requires a different approach. The workers there are harder, ground down by years of exposure to industrial toxins and the constant threat of workplace accidents. They don't scare as easily as the merchants, which means the violence has to be more direct and more memorable. A supervisor who tries to shortchange the tribute might find himself missing fingers, while a worker who spreads talk of resistance usually ends up as an object lesson for his shift mates. The hab blocks present their own challenges. Families crowded into single rooms have little to give, but desperation makes people dangerous in unpredictable ways. I've learned to read the signs, the way a man's shoulders tense when he's considering whether to fight rather than pay, the particular look in a woman's eyes when she's calculating whether her children would be better off as orphans than witnesses to her humiliation. These moments require careful handling, because dead tribute payers generate no ongoing revenue. Our current territorial dispute with the Void Serpents has transformed routine collection work into something approaching warfare. The conflict centers on control of a weapons smuggling route that runs through the collapsed transit tunnels beneath Sector Quintanus. These tunnels were part of an ambitious transport network that was supposed to connect the lower hive to the spaceport, but funding dried up during construction, leaving behind a maze of half-finished passages and abandoned work sites that now serve as perfect conduits for illegal trade. The weapons that flow through these tunnels represent serious money: auto gun parts manufactured in off-world facilities, ammunition stockpiles diverted from Imperial Guard shipments, and occasionally more exotic items like plasma weapon components or Melta charges. The Void Serpents had controlled the southern approach to the tunnel network for almost 2 years before we identified the opportunity and began our push to claim it. The escalation started small, as these things usually do. A few Serpent runners went missing in our territory, their bodies turning up in waste processing vats with their gang tattoos carved off. They responded by hitting one of our tribute collection points, leaving three of our street soldiers dead and sending a message that they wouldn't tolerate our expansion. The violence has been building steadily since then, turning every collection run into a potential ambush site. The tunnel network itself is a nightmare of collapsed sections and flooded passages, with air quality that would kill an unprotected human in minutes. The smugglers who use it wear respirators and move in small, fast groups, timing their runs to avoid both gang patrols and the occasional security sweep by enforcers from the upper levels. The profit margins are enormous, but so are the risks, not just from gang violence, but from the tunnels themselves, which claim lives through cave-ins, toxic gas pockets, and the occasional encounter with the feral human tribes that have made homes in the deepest sections. My role in this conflict extends beyond simple muscle work. The gang leadership recognizes that controlling the tunnel network requires more than just firepower. It demands intelligence gathering, route planning, and the kind of systematic intimidation that convinces rival operations to relocate rather than fight. I've spent weeks mapping the Serpent's patrol patterns, identifying their key personnel, and developing strategies for disrupting their operations without triggering the kind of all-out war that would draw unwanted attention from the enforcers. The chemical processing facilities that dominate our sector provide excellent cover for these activities. The constant noise and toxic emissions make surveillance difficult, while the maze of pipes and storage tanks offers countless hiding spots for weapons caches and meeting points. The facility workers have learned not to ask questions about unusual activity in the restricted sections, understanding that curiosity is a luxury they can't afford. The Serpents operate differently than we do, favoring speed and stealth over the systematic intimidation that defines Crimson Talon operations. Their territory in Sector Octavius is better maintained than ours, with functioning power grids and water recycling systems that suggest either better connections to the upper hive or more sophisticated tribute extraction methods. Their enforcers carry better weapons and wear armor that shows signs of professional maintenance, rather than the jury-rigged protection gear that most gang members rely on. This technological advantage has made direct confrontation costly for both sides. The last major engagement left 7 Talons dead and cost us a significant weapons cache when the Serpents managed to overrun one of our storage sites. The leadership's response was swift and brutal. 3 Serpent sympathizers in our territory were found hanging from overhead pipes as a reminder that collaboration has consequences. The ongoing conflict has changed the rhythm of daily life in Sector Quintanus. Tribute collection now requires armed escorts, while routine maintenance of our territory has become secondary to preparing defensive positions and gathering intelligence on Serpent movements. The merchants and workers who pay tribute have noticed the increased tension, and some have begun making inquiries about relocating to neutral territory, a development that threatens our long-term revenue streams. The waste processing facilities have become particularly important strategic assets, as their location provides direct access to the tunnel network while offering multiple escape routes in case of enforcer raids. The facility supervisors have been cooperative, understanding that their continued operation depends on maintaining good relations with whoever controls the surrounding territory. Their workers have been less accommodating, requiring occasional reminders about the importance of discretion regarding unusual activity in the processing areas. The job that morning started like any other routine intimidation run. Korvac had assigned me and 3 other Talons to lean on a merchant named Thaddeus Vorn, who operated a small import business near the Manufactorum District's eastern edge. Vorn had been late with his tribute payments for 2 weeks running, claiming supply chain disruptions and increased enforcer scrutiny were cutting into his profits. The excuses might have been legitimate, but allowing one merchant to slide inevitably led to others testing their luck, and maintaining discipline required swift correction. I brought Hectus Malver and young Jarek with me for the collection. Hectus carried an auto pistol tucked into his coat, while Malver preferred the intimidation factor of a length of industrial chain wrapped around his forearm. Jarek was still proving himself to the gang, eager to demonstrate his reliability through whatever violence the situation demanded. The four of us made our way through the twisting alleyways that connected our territory to the Manufactorum loading docks where Vorn conducted his business. The air quality near the Manufactorums was particularly foul that morning, thick with metallic particles that coated the inside of your throat and made breathing feel like swallowing rust. Chemical runoff from the production facilities had pooled in the lower sections of the street, creating oily puddles that reflected the amber glow of the overhead luminators in sickly rainbow patterns. The constant mechanical grinding from the factories provided a backdrop of noise that would mask any sounds our business with Vorn might generate. Vorn's operation occupied a converted loading bay in a structure that had seen better decades. The building's rockcrete walls showed stress fractures from years of heavy machinery vibrations, while the reinforced doors bore scorch marks from some long-forgotten industrial accident. His legitimate business involved importing textiles and basic manufactured goods from off-world sources, though everyone understood that such operations typically involved side ventures that generated more profitable returns than legal trade. We approached the loading dock through the main entrance, expecting to find Vorn and perhaps one or two workers managing inventory or preparing shipments. The first sign that something was wrong came when I noticed the unusual number of cargo containers stacked around the facility's perimeter. These weren't the standard textile shipment containers that Vorn typically handled, but heavy-duty transport units with reinforced seals and shipping codes that didn't match any commercial freight patterns I recognized. Hectus spotted the guards first, positioned at intervals around the loading area with a level of professional alertness that immediately set off warning signals. These weren't the usual dock workers or hired muscle that merchants employed for basic security. They wore dark clothing that looked suspiciously like military fatigues, and their equipment included what appeared to be military-grade lasgun rifles and flak armor vests of a quality that suggested off-world procurement. The realization that we had walked into something far more serious than a routine collection hit me just as one of the guards noticed our approach and began reaching for his weapon. The professional manner in which he moved, combined with the coordinated response from his companions, confirmed that these were trained soldiers rather than local hired guns. The distinctive whine of charging lasgun power cells filled the air as multiple weapons swung in our direction. The firefight erupted without warning or negotiation. The first volley of lasgun fire turned the loading dock into a chaos of brilliant energy beams and the acrid smell of burned air. The confined space of the facility worked against us, providing limited cover while giving the mercenaries clear fields of fire from their elevated positions near the cargo containers. Malver took a direct hit to the chest that punched through his jacket and sent him sprawling behind a stack of shipping crates, his chain weapon clattering across the rockcrete floor. I dove for cover behind a loading crane, feeling the heat of Law's bolts searing past my head as the mercenaries maintained disciplined fire patterns that spoke of professional military training. The distinctive crack hiss of lasgun discharge echoed through the facility, punctuated by the metallic ping of energy beams striking machinery and structural supports. Jarek had found shelter behind a fuel drum, but his position left him exposed to crossfire from multiple angles. The mercenaries advanced with textbook precision, using covering fire and coordinated movement to maintain pressure while minimizing their own exposure. Their equipment was clearly superior to anything our gang typically encountered. The flak armor absorbed hits that should have dropped them, while their lasguns maintained consistent power output that suggested recent maintenance and quality ammunition. One of them produced a crack grenade from his equipment harness, the distinctive cylindrical shape immediately recognizable as military ordnance. The explosion that followed turned the section of loading dock where Hectus had taken cover into a crater of twisted metal and scattered debris. The concussive force knocked me sideways, filling my ears with a ringing that made it difficult to track the continuing gunfire. Chunks of rockcrete and metal fragments pelted the area around my position, while the acrid smoke from the detonation mixed with the chemical atmosphere to create a choking haze that burned my lungs. Jarek's position became untenable when two mercenaries flanked his fuel drum cover, their coordinated advance leaving him caught between multiple firing angles. His attempts to return fire with his stub pistol were pathetically inadequate against their professional equipment and training. The sustained lasgun fire that cut him down lasted only seconds, but the precision of the shots demonstrated the kind of marksmanship that came from extensive combat experience rather than street fighting. The situation had deteriorated beyond any possibility of successful engagement or negotiated withdrawal. The mercenaries controlled the loading dock through superior firepower and positioning, while their obvious military training gave them tactical advantages that no amount of gang experience could overcome. The smart play was immediate retreat, but the facility's layout offered limited escape routes that didn't involve crossing open ground under direct fire. The ventilation system provided the only viable exit strategy. A maintenance access panel near my position led to the facility's air circulation network, designed to handle the toxic fumes generated by the various industrial processes conducted in the building. The ductwork was barely large enough to accommodate human passage, but it offered concealment from the mercenaries and potential access to other sections of the facility. Crawling through the ventilation system proved to be its own form of torture. The ducts carried concentrated industrial fumes that made breathing feel like inhaling liquid fire, while the metal surfaces radiated heat from the facility's processing equipment. Chemical residue coated every surface with a slick film that made progress difficult and left my hands burning from contact with unknown toxins. The confined space forced me to move in a low crawl that put stress on every joint, while the metal edges of the ductwork scraped against my back and shoulders. The sounds of the continuing firefight filtered through the ventilation system, distorted by the metal ducting but still clearly audible. The disciplined crack of lasgun fire continued for several more minutes, suggesting that at least some of my companions were still alive and fighting. The occasional thump of another crack grenade detonation punctuated the battle, each explosion marking another section of the loading dock being systematically cleared by the mercenaries. The screaming started about 10 minutes after I entered the ductwork. The sounds carried through the facility's acoustic structure with horrifying clarity, transforming the industrial background noise into a backdrop for human agony. The voices belonged to Hectus and Jarek, though the pain distorted their words beyond recognition. The mercenaries were conducting interrogations with methods that suggested both professional training and complete disregard for human suffering. The questions being asked filtered through layers of pain and the facility's acoustic distortion, focused on gang operations and territorial control. The mercenaries wanted information about Crimson Talon leadership, our weapons caches, and our knowledge of other criminal operations in the sector. Their interrogation techniques demonstrated the kind of systematic approach to information extraction that suggested military intelligence backgrounds rather than simple hired muscle. The ventilation system eventually led to an external access point in the facility's upper structure, where industrial exhaust vents provided connection to the outside atmosphere. The exit required climbing through a vertical shaft filled with toxic fumes that made the horizontal ducts seem pleasant by comparison. Chemical burns on my hands and face marked contact with the concentrated industrial waste that the system was designed to evacuate, while my lungs felt raw from breathing air that was more poison than oxygen. Emerging from the facility into the perpetual twilight of Nostromo's streets felt like resurrection, despite the fact that the outside air quality was only marginally better than what I had endured in the ventilation system. The sounds of the interrogation continued to echo from the loading dock, though distance and the ambient noise of the Manufactorum district made the details less distinct. The screaming had taken on a different quality that suggested the mercenaries were moving beyond simple questioning into more elaborate forms of persuasion. The cargo containers that had first alerted me to the unusual nature of Vorn's operation took on new significance as I observed them from a concealed position across the street. The shipping codes and security seals were unlike anything used for standard commercial freight, while the reinforced construction suggested contents that required protection from more than simple theft or environmental damage. The mercenaries guarding the shipment represented an investment in security that far exceeded what any textile import business could justify. The realization that we had stumbled into an Archaeotech smuggling operation explained both the quality of the security and the systematic nature of the interrogation. Archaeotech artifacts commanded prices that made weapons smuggling look like petty theft, while possession of such items carried penalties that ranged from execution to worse fates involving the Inquisition. The merchants and criminals who dealt in such contraband operated at levels of the underworld that made gang territorial disputes seem like playground squabbles. The implications for the Crimson Talons were immediately clear and universally bad. Our routine intimidation of a late-paying merchant had brought us into contact with criminal operations that possessed resources and connections far beyond our capacity to challenge or contain. The mercenaries conducting the interrogation would extract every detail about our organization, our territory, and our operations, information that could be used to eliminate us as potential witnesses or sold to rival gangs seeking advantages in ongoing territorial conflicts. The screaming from the loading dock had stopped, replaced by the efficient sounds of the mercenaries cleaning up their operation. The silence that followed was more ominous than the previous sounds of violence, suggesting that my former companions had provided whatever information their captors required. The methodical nature of the cleanup indicated that the Archaeotech shipment would be moved quickly, leaving behind only the kind of evidence that would confuse rather than illuminate any subsequent investigation. The Archaeotech smuggling operation vanished within hours of the firefight, leaving behind only scorched rockcrete and the lingering smell of ozone from discharged Law's weapons. I spent the remainder of that day hiding in the chemical processing facility's maintenance tunnels, waiting for the inevitable response from the enforcers. The mercenaries had been too professional to leave loose ends, which meant the bodies of my companions would be discovered along with enough evidence to trigger a major security response. The first enforcer patrols arrived at dawn, their armored vehicles grinding through the narrow streets with the distinctive whine of turbine engines that could be heard three sectors away. From my concealed position in a drainage culvert, I watched the black-painted rhino transports disgorge squads of riot-armored enforcers who moved with the kind of systematic precision that spoke of extensive urban warfare experience. Their equipment was Imperial Guard surplus, carapace armor, Hellgun rifles, and tactical gear that made even the Archaeotech smugglers' mercenaries look under-equipped. Enforcer Cassius Thorne arrived in the third wave of vehicles, his command chimera distinguished by additional communication arrays and the kind of reinforced armor plating that suggested he had survived more than his share of assassination attempts. Thorne himself was a walking monument to the brutality required to maintain order on Nostromo, his augmetic left arm ending in a power fist that showed signs of recent use, while ritual scarification covered the visible portions of his face in patterns that spoke of off-world military service. The way his subordinates moved around him suggested a combination of professional respect and genuine fear. The investigation of Vorn's facility proceeded with methodical thoroughness that left no surface unexamined and no potential witness unquestioned. Thorne's enforcers had clearly dealt with Archaeotech smuggling operations before, recognizing the signs of professional criminal activity that distinguished such operations from routine gang violence. The systematic way they cataloged evidence and secured the scene indicated they understood the implications of finding military-grade equipment and off-world mercenary involvement in what should have been a simple territorial dispute. The discovery of Hectus and Jarek's bodies triggered an immediate escalation in enforcer activity throughout Sector Quintanus. The condition of the corpses made it clear that professional interrogation techniques had been employed, while the precision of the killing shots demonstrated the kind of marksmanship that came from military training rather than gang warfare. Thorne's response was swift and comprehensive, establishing checkpoints at every major intersection while deploying patrol units to conduct random sweeps of suspected criminal gathering points. The enforcer's knowledge of Crimson Talon operations proved disturbingly comprehensive, suggesting either extensive surveillance networks or information provided by captured gang members during previous operations. Their raids targeted safe houses and weapons caches with accuracy that could only come from detailed intelligence, while their arrest lists included names of mid-level operatives who had believed their involvement in gang activities remained secret. The systematic nature of the crackdown indicated that Thorne intended to dismantle our entire organizational structure rather than simply responding to the immediate incident. My own position became untenable within 48 hours of the massacre. Enforcer patrols had established a pattern of regular sweeps through the chemical processing facilities, while informant networks that had previously provided early warning of security operations had been systematically compromised. The safe houses I had relied on for shelter were either under surveillance or had been raided, leaving me with limited options for avoiding capture. The tribute collection routes that had provided both income and cover for movement were now patrolled by armed enforcers who shot suspected gang members on site. The Underhive's waste reclamation sectors offered the only viable refuge from the intensifying security sweeps. These facilities process the toxic runoff from the Upper Hive's industrial operations, creating an environment so hostile that even the enforcers limited their patrols to essential personnel equipped with full environmental protection gear. The atmospheric composition in the reclamation areas included concentrations of industrial solvents and heavy metals that would kill unprotected humans within hours, while the machinery that processed the waste generated noise levels that made communication impossible without specialized equipment. Surviving in the waste reclamation sectors required adaptations that pushed human endurance beyond reasonable limits. The water available from the facility's emergency systems was contaminated with chemical residues that caused immediate nausea and left a metallic taste that lingered for hours after consumption. The corpse starch rations I had salvaged from abandoned gang supply caches were barely edible under normal circumstances, but the toxic atmosphere made eating feel like swallowing poison, while the constant chemical exposure left my digestive system in permanent distress. The psychological toll of constant hiding began to manifest within the first week of my refuge in the reclamation sectors. The isolation was absolute, broken only by the distant sounds of enforcer patrols conducting their systematic destruction of everything I had spent years building. Sleep became impossible in any meaningful sense, replaced by brief periods of unconsciousness interrupted by the industrial noise of the waste processing machinery and the persistent fear that discovery meant immediate execution. The enforcers' interrogation methods became apparent as former associates began appearing in the main thoroughfares as object lessons for anyone considering resistance. Mordo, who had controlled tribute collection in the eastern hab blocks, was found hanging from a transit bridge with his hands removed and his chest cavity open to display the systematic damage that had been inflicted before his death. The precision of the wounds indicated the use of medical knowledge in the torture process, while the public display of his corpse sent a clear message about the consequences of gang involvement. Watching the systematic dismantling of the Crimson Talons from my toxic refuge provided a perspective on the fragility of the criminal ecosystem that had seemed so permanent and powerful. The tribute collection networks that had generated steady income for years collapsed within days as merchants either fled the sector or began cooperating with enforcer investigations. The weapons caches that had represented months of careful acquisition were discovered and destroyed, while the safe houses that had provided security and meeting places were turned into killing grounds for anyone foolish enough to approach them. The enforcers demonstrated a thorough understanding of gang psychology in their approach to dismantling our organization. Rather than simply arresting known criminals, they focused on destroying the infrastructure that made gang operations possible. The merchants who had paid tribute found their businesses subjected to intensive taxation and regulatory scrutiny that made cooperation with criminal organizations financially impossible. The workers who had provided information and services discovered that association with gang members now carried penalties that extended to their families and associates. Korvac's fate became clear during my third week in the waste reclamation sectors, when his body appeared suspended from the main transit bridge that connected Sector Quintanis to the Manufactorum District. The enforcers had taken their time with him, using techniques that kept him alive and conscious throughout an interrogation process that had lasted several days based on the condition of his remains. His gang tattoos had been removed with surgical precision, while the systematic damage to his extremities indicated the use of specialized tools designed for extracting information through pain. The public display of Korvac's corpse served multiple purposes beyond simple intimidation. The location of the suspension made it visible from multiple sectors, ensuring that the message reached criminal organizations throughout the lower hive. The condition of the body demonstrated the enforcers' capabilities in information extraction, while the ritual aspects of the display suggested that Thorne understood the psychological warfare required to maintain control over populations that had little left to lose. The evidence of extensive questioning was visible in the systematic nature of the damage inflicted on Korvac's body. His fingers had been removed individually, likely over the course of several hours, while burns from heated metal implements covered his torso in patterns that suggested methodical application rather than random torture. The precision of the wounds indicated medical knowledge in their application, while the survival time required for such extensive damage spoke of careful attention to maintaining consciousness throughout the process. The information extracted from Korvac's interrogation became apparent as enforcer raids intensified throughout the sector with accuracy that could only come from detailed intelligence about gang operations. Safe houses that had been secret for years were hit simultaneously, while weapons caches hidden in locations known only to senior gang members were discovered and destroyed. The systematic nature of the raids indicated that Thorne's interrogators had extracted comprehensive information about Crimson Talon operations, leaving no aspect of our organization unexposed. The psychological impact of watching former associates subjected to public torture and execution created a constant state of terror that made rational decision-making increasingly difficult. Every sound in the waste reclamation facility could signal the approach of enforcer patrols, while every shadow might conceal surveillance equipment or hidden observers. The toxic atmosphere that provided protection from detection also created a constant reminder of mortality, as the chemical exposure caused progressive deterioration that manifested in persistent coughing, skin lesions, and digestive problems that worsened daily. The collapse of the Crimson Talons created opportunities for rival gangs to expand their territory, but the enforcers' continued presence made any attempt at reorganization suicidal. The Void Serpents had attempted to claim some of our former tribute collection routes, only to discover that Thorne's patrols were targeting any criminal activity with lethal force, regardless of gang affiliation. The systematic nature of the security response suggested that the Archaeotech smuggling incident had triggered a broader crackdown intended to eliminate organized crime from the sector entirely. The waste reclamation sectors that provided my refuge were themselves under increasing scrutiny as the enforcers expanded their search patterns. Patrol schedules that had initially avoided the most toxic areas began including regular sweeps with fully equipped environmental teams, while surveillance equipment was installed at access points that had previously been unmonitored. The gradual tightening of security made it clear that my current hiding place would eventually be discovered, forcing consideration of increasingly desperate alternatives for continued survival. The deteriorating conditions in the waste reclamation sectors finally forced me deeper into Nostromo Secundus than I had ever ventured before. The enforcers had begun deploying specialized atmospheric processors that could neutralize the toxic gases protecting my refuge, while their patrol patterns now included systematic sweeps of every maintenance tunnel and processing chamber. The chemical burns covering my hands and face had worsened to the point where infection was becoming a serious concern, while the contaminated water and spoiled rations were causing internal damage that manifested in blood-tinged vomit and constant abdominal pain. The descent into the industrial underbelly required navigating through collapsed transit tunnels that had been abandoned during the hive's construction phases. These passages connected the waste reclamation facilities to the deeper machinery complexes that powered Nostromo Secundus, creating a network of forgotten spaces where the hive's original architects had installed systems too dangerous for regular maintenance access. The air quality deteriorated with each level of descent, transforming from merely toxic to actively corrosive as industrial runoff from centuries of operation had created atmospheric conditions that dissolved exposed metal and organic matter with equal efficiency. The first signs of other survivors appeared three levels down from the reclamation sectors, where crude barricades constructed from scavenged machinery parts blocked access to the main transit arteries. These fortifications showed signs of hasty construction combined with desperate ingenuity, incorporating everything from broken conveyor belt segments to discarded chemical storage tanks into defensive positions that could channel attackers into predetermined killing zones. The builders had clearly understood the tactical requirements of defending choke points against superior numbers, though the materials available limited their effectiveness against professional military equipment. The survivors who had constructed these defenses represented the dregs of multiple gang organizations that had been shattered by recent enforcer operations. Former Void Serpents worked alongside remnants of the Iron Skulls and Bleeding Edge gangs, their traditional rivalries set aside by the shared necessity of avoiding execution. The alliance was purely pragmatic, based on the understanding that individual gang fragments lacked the resources to survive in the hostile environment of the Deep Underhive, while cooperation offered marginal improvements in security and resource acquisition. Their leader was a scarred woman named Catrix Voss, formerly a mid-level enforcer for the Iron Skulls before that organization was dismantled in a series of raids that had preceded the Crimson Talon crackdown by several months. Her left arm ended at the elbow, the result of an enforcer interrogation that had gone particularly badly, while ritual scarification covered her scalp in patterns that indicated she had served time in one of the Upper Hive's penal facilities. The respect she commanded from the other survivors stemmed from her demonstrated ability to organize successful scavenging operations while avoiding the kind of mistakes that led to capture or death. The living conditions in their makeshift settlement defied description in terms that adequately conveyed the depths of human degradation they represented. Sleeping areas consisted of spaces carved from industrial debris and lined with whatever insulating materials could be scavenged from the surrounding machinery. The air was thick with chemical vapors that caused immediate respiratory distress, while the water supply came from condensation collected from cooling pipes that carried runoff from processing facilities several levels above. Food consisted entirely of whatever organic matter could be salvaged from waste disposal systems, supplemented by the occasional rat or other vermin that had adapted to the toxic environment. The psychological toll of their situation was evident in the behaviors and mannerisms that marked each survivor as someone pushed beyond normal human limits. Conversations were conducted in whispers despite the constant industrial noise that would mask normal speech, while sudden movements or unexpected sounds triggered defensive reactions that spoke of constant hypervigilance. Several of the survivors showed signs of advanced chemical poisoning, including skin lesions that refused to heal and respiratory problems that made any physical exertion a struggle for survival. Catrix explained their situation during my first night in their settlement, describing how the various gang fragments had been driven deeper into the Underhive by successive waves of enforcer operations that had targeted criminal organizations throughout the sector. The systematic nature of the crackdowns suggested coordination between different enforcer units, while the timing indicated that the authorities had decided to eliminate organized crime from multiple sectors simultaneously rather than simply responding to individual incidents. The deeper levels of the Underhive presented challenges that went beyond simple survival, as the ancient machinery that powered the Hive's basic functions continued to operate according to programming that had been installed centuries earlier. Massive grinding gears processed raw materials according to production schedules that no longer corresponded to any actual manufacturing requirements, while automated furnaces maintained temperatures that could incinerate human beings instantly if they ventured too close to the thermal regulation systems. The machinery operated without regard for human presence, following algorithmic patterns that treated anything within their operational parameters as potential raw material for processing. Navigation through these mechanical hazards required intimate knowledge of the operational cycles that governed each system, information that had been accumulated through trial and error by survivors who had lost companions to the various automated death traps. The grinding gears that processed ore from the mining levels operated on 18-hour cycles, creating brief windows when it was safe to cross the processing chambers, while the furnace systems maintained irregular heating patterns that could only be predicted by observing the subtle changes in ambient temperature that preceded each activation cycle. The sound of the machinery was overwhelming, creating a constant cacophony of grinding metal, hydraulic pressure releases, and thermal expansion that made communication impossible except through hand signals and predetermined gestures. The noise levels were sufficient to cause permanent hearing damage within hours of exposure, while the vibrations from the heavy machinery created structural instabilities that made cave ins a constant threat. Several sections of the tunnel network had been sealed off after ceiling collapses that had claimed the lives of scavengers who had failed to recognize the warning signs of imminent structural failure. The automated systems presented opportunities as well as dangers, as their processing operations occasionally produced useful materials that could be salvaged by survivors willing to risk exposure to the mechanical hazards. Metal components processed by the grinding systems sometimes included materials suitable for weapon construction, while the thermal processing units occasionally produced refined chemicals that could be used for medical purposes or traded to other survivor groups. The key to successful scavenging was understanding the timing of the operational cycles and identifying the brief moments when valuable materials could be retrieved without triggering the automated defense systems. Our first major scavenging operation targeted a supply convoy that serviced the automated machinery systems, carrying replacement parts and maintenance supplies through the tunnel network on a predetermined schedule that had remained unchanged for decades. The convoy consisted of three automated cargo haulers that followed magnetic guidance systems embedded in the tunnel floors, their progress marked by the distinctive whine of electric motors and the rhythmic clacking of wheels on metal tracks. The haulers were protected by basic security systems designed to prevent tampering, but these defenses were intended to deter casual theft rather than organized assault. The plan developed by Catrix involved creating a controlled cave in that would block the convoy's progress while providing cover for the assault team, though the execution required precise timing to avoid being crushed by the falling debris. The survivors had identified a section of tunnel where structural damage from previous operations had weakened the ceiling supports, creating conditions where a small explosive charge could trigger a collapse that would seal off the convoy route without causing damage to the wider tunnel network. The explosive device was constructed from chemicals salvaged from the automated processing systems, combined with metal components that had been shaped using the grinding machinery during its inactive periods. The resulting bomb was crude but effective, designed to create maximum structural damage rather than the focused destruction that would be required for anti-personnel use. The timer mechanism was equally primitive, relying on a chemical reaction that would provide approximately 10 minutes of delay between activation and detonation. The assault team consisted of 8 survivors armed with whatever weapons could be constructed from scavenged materials, including sharpened metal fragments, improvised clubs, and a single auto gun that had been recovered from a previous enforcer patrol. The ammunition for the auto gun was limited to 7 rounds, making it useful primarily for intimidation rather than sustained combat, while the improvised weapons were effective only at close range against unarmored targets. The convoy arrived precisely on schedule, its automated guidance systems following the predetermined route without any apparent awareness of the trap that had been prepared. The cargo haulers moved with mechanical persistence, their electric motors maintaining constant speed despite the deteriorating track conditions and the accumulating debris that marked the approach to the ambush site. The lead hauler triggered the explosive device exactly as planned, though the resulting cave-in was more extensive than anticipated, sealing off not just the convoy route, but also several adjacent passages that had served as potential escape routes. The assault on the trapped convoy revealed the limitations of our improvised equipment when confronted with even basic security systems. The cargo haulers were equipped with defensive mechanisms that included electrified hull plating and automated weapon systems that targeted anything approaching within a predetermined radius. The first survivor to reach the lead hauler was killed instantly when he made contact with the electrified surface, while the automated weapon system began firing concentrated las bursts that forced the assault team to take cover behind the fallen debris. The firefight that followed demonstrated the desperate nature of our situation, as 8 survivors with improvised weapons attempted to overcome automated defense systems that had been designed by Imperial engineers. The LAS weapon system mounted on each cargo hauler maintained consistent accuracy despite the confined space and poor visibility, while the power supply seemed unlimited compared to the single auto gun that represented our only comparable firepower. 2 more survivors were killed during the initial exchange, their improvised armor providing no protection against military-grade energy weapons. The breakthrough came when one of the survivors managed to reach the magnetic guidance system that controlled the convoy's movement, using a metal fragment to short-circuit the control mechanisms and disable the automated defenses. The electrical discharge that resulted from the sabotage was sufficient to overload the weapon systems, though it also caused a fire that threatened to spread to the cargo containers and destroy whatever supplies we had hoped to capture. The contents of the cargo haulers provided insights into the scope of the conspiracy that had led to our current situation, as the maintenance supplies included components that were clearly intended for Archaeotech systems rather than standard Imperial machinery. The shipping manifests found in the lead hauler's control compartment referenced delivery schedules to facilities that didn't appear on any official Hive schematics, while the authorization codes were issued by administrative offices that had supposedly been closed for decades. The evidence suggested that the Archaeotech smuggling operation we had stumbled into was part of a larger network that involved corrupt officials throughout the Hive's administrative structure. The maintenance supplies were being delivered to hidden facilities where Archaeotech artifacts were processed and prepared for off-world shipment, while the official records were being falsified to conceal the existence of these operations from Imperial oversight. The scope of the conspiracy explained the professional nature of the security response and the systematic approach to eliminating potential witnesses. The discovery of the conspiracy's extent created new dangers for our survivor group, as possession of evidence linking corrupt officials to Archaeotech smuggling carried penalties that extended beyond simple execution. The shipping manifests and authorization codes represented information that could be used to expose the entire network, making us valuable as potential witnesses, but also targets for elimination by anyone involved in the conspiracy. The professional mercenaries who had killed my former gang members were likely still operating in the area, tasked with eliminating anyone who had gained knowledge of the smuggling operations. The evidence we had recovered from the convoy created an immediate dilemma that divided our small group of survivors. Catrix believed the shipping manifests and authorization codes represented our only chance of negotiating safe passage out of the Underhive, while others argued that possessing such information made us targets for elimination by forces far more dangerous than the enforcers. The debate continued through the night as we huddled around the smoldering remains of the cargo haulers, the acrid smoke from burning electronics mixing with the perpetual chemical stench that permeated the deeper levels. I found myself studying the authorization codes with growing unease, recognizing patterns that suggested connections to administrative offices I had encountered during my years of tribute collection. Several of the facility designations matched locations where wealthy merchants had claimed to conduct legitimate business, while the shipping schedules corresponded to periods when unusual security activity had been observed in the upper commercial districts. The conspiracy extended far beyond simple archaeotech smuggling, encompassing a network of corrupt officials who had been using the criminal underworld as expendable assets in their larger schemes. The realization struck me with the force of a physical blow as I connected the timing of recent gang wars to the shipping schedules found in the convoy's documentation. The territorial disputes that had consumed the Crimson Talons and Void Serpents had coincided perfectly with periods when the smuggling network required distractions from enforcer attention, while the systematic elimination of gang leadership had occurred precisely when the Archaeotech shipments were being moved through the sector. We had been manipulated into providing cover for criminal operations that dwarfed anything our gangs had ever attempted. The scope of the manipulation became clearer as I cross-referenced the convoy's maintenance schedules with my memories of enforcer patrol patterns during the past year. The security sweeps that had seemed random and opportunistic had actually followed predetermined patterns designed to drive criminal activity towards specific areas where it could be monitored and controlled. The gangs had been herded like livestock, their territorial disputes managed to serve the needs of the Archaeotech smuggling network while ensuring that potential witnesses remained focused on immediate survival rather than larger patterns. Catrix had reached similar conclusions through her own analysis of the evidence, her scarred features reflecting the grim understanding that our entire criminal careers had been orchestrated by forces we had never suspected existed. The Iron Skulls had been eliminated not because of any specific threat they posed, but because their territory overlapped with shipping routes that the conspiracy needed to secure. The timing of their destruction had cleared the way for expanded smuggling operations while providing a demonstration of what happened to criminal organizations that became inconvenient. The other survivors struggled to comprehend the implications of what we had discovered, their understanding limited by years of focusing on immediate threats rather than strategic thinking. The concept that their gang affiliations had been manipulated by corrupt officials required a level of abstract reasoning that most street criminals never developed, while the evidence itself was too complex for quick comprehension by people whose education had ended with basic literacy. The shipping manifests might as well have been written in High Gothic for all the meaning they conveyed to most of our group. The debate over what to do with the evidence was interrupted by the distant sound of heavy machinery that differed from the usual automated processing systems. The rhythmic grinding of tracked vehicles echoed through the tunnel network, accompanied by the distinctive whine of turbine engines that marked the approach of enforcer assault vehicles. The professional nature of the search pattern suggested that our attack on the convoy had been detected, triggering a response that would systematically clear the tunnel network of any potential witnesses. The sound of the approaching vehicles created immediate panic among the survivors, as their previous encounters with enforcer operations had demonstrated the futility of resistance against professional military equipment. The improvised weapons that had barely been adequate against automated defense systems would be useless against armored personnel carriers equipped with heavy weapons and operated by trained soldiers. The confined space of the tunnel network that had provided protection from casual patrols now became a trap that limited escape routes while channeling the enforcers' advance toward our position. Catrix attempted to organize a fighting withdrawal toward the deeper tunnel levels, but the structural damage from our convoy ambush had sealed off several potential escape routes while creating choke points that would force us into direct confrontation with superior firepower. The cave-in that had trapped the cargo haulers now blocked access to the main transit arteries, while the smaller maintenance passages were too narrow to accommodate rapid movement by a group of 8 survivors carrying salvaged equipment. The first Enforcer probe units appeared at the tunnel entrance within minutes of our detection of their approach, their movements coordinated with the precision that marked professional urban warfare specialists. The soldiers wore full environmental protection gear that allowed them to operate in the toxic atmosphere without degraded performance, while their equipment included specialized sensors that could track human presence through the chemical haze that filled the tunnel network. The systematic way they advanced suggested they had detailed intelligence about the tunnel layout and our likely positions. I made the decision to separate from the main group, taking the shipping manifests and authorization codes, while the others attempted to draw Enforcer attention toward the deeper machinery levels. The evidence represented the only proof that the gang wars had been orchestrated by corrupt officials, making its preservation more important than individual survival. The narrow maintenance passages that connected the processing chambers offered potential routes toward the surface, though the journey would require navigating through automated systems that had already claimed several lives during previous escape attempts. The sound of gunfire erupted behind me as the Enforcers engaged the other survivors, the distinctive crack of hellgun discharge echoing through the tunnel network with terrifying intensity. The professional weapons created a sustained barrage that overwhelmed any attempt at coordinated resistance, while the confined space amplified the sound until it became a physical assault on the senses. The screaming that followed confirmed that the Enforcers were taking prisoners for interrogation rather than simply eliminating witnesses, a development that made escape even more urgent. The maintenance passages that led toward the surface proved to be a nightmare of automated hazards and structural instability that had been worsened by decades of neglect and chemical corrosion. The metal walkways that provided access to the machinery systems were corroded to the point where they could barely support human weight, while the chemical atmosphere had created atmospheric conditions that made breathing feel like drowning in acid. Each level of ascent brought new challenges as the automated systems became more complex and the margin for error decreased. The grinding machinery that processed raw materials operated according to cycles that had become increasingly erratic as the control systems deteriorated over time. What had once been predictable 18-hour patterns had devolved into chaotic sequences that could activate without warning, turning safe passages into death traps within seconds. The sound of the machinery provided no reliable indication of operational status, as the acoustic environment was too distorted by chemical interference to allow accurate assessment of mechanical conditions. The first major obstacle appeared 3 levels up from the tunnel network, where a massive ore processing system blocked the main ascent route with grinding wheels that operated at speeds sufficient to pulverize human bones instantly. The system had been designed to process mineral deposits from the mining levels, but decades of operation had worn the safety interlocks to the point where the machinery could activate randomly regardless of whether raw materials were present for processing. The timing mechanism that controlled the operational cycles had become so unreliable that crossing the processing chamber required accepting the possibility of immediate death. I waited for what seemed like hours, monitoring the subtle changes in vibration patterns that might indicate the beginning of an inactive period, before making the crossing with desperate speed that pushed my chemically damaged lungs beyond their capacity. The grinding wheels remained motionless as I scrambled across the processing chamber, though the sound of hydraulic systems suggested that the machinery was building pressure for another operational cycle. The margin of safety was measured in seconds rather than minutes, leaving no room for hesitation or mistakes. The next level presented thermal hazards that were even more dangerous than the mechanical threats below, as automated furnaces maintained temperatures that could incinerate organic matter instantly while filling the atmosphere with superheated gases that caused immediate respiratory damage. The furnace systems operated according to thermal regulation patterns that had been designed to maintain consistent temperatures for industrial processes that no longer existed, creating an environment where survival required understanding heat distribution patterns that changed according to incomprehensible algorithmic sequences. The evidence I carried became increasingly important as I climbed toward the surface, representing the only proof that the gang wars had been orchestrated by corrupt officials who used criminal organizations as expendable assets in their archaeotech smuggling operations. The shipping manifests contained enough information to expose the entire network, while the authorization codes could be traced to specific administrative offices that had been falsifying records to conceal the conspiracy. The scope of the corruption extended throughout the Hive's power structure, making the evidence valuable enough to justify the risks involved in reaching the surface. The sound of pursuit echoed through the maintenance passages as enforcer search teams began following my escape route, their progress marked by the systematic destruction of automated systems that posed obstacles to their advance. The professional nature of their approach suggested they understood the importance of the evidence I carried, while their willingness to risk the mechanical hazards indicated they had received orders that prioritized recovery of the shipping manifests over soldier safety. The sound of controlled explosions marked their progress as they cleared obstacles with military efficiency. The final ascent to the surface levels required navigating through a section of the Hive's original construction that had been abandoned during the early phases of development, leaving behind a maze of unfinished passages and structural supports that had been weakened by centuries of chemical exposure. The atmospheric conditions improved marginally with each level of ascent, though the air quality remained toxic enough to cause progressive damage to exposed skin and respiratory systems. The evidence of chemical burns covered my hands and face, while the constant exposure to industrial toxins had created internal damage that manifested in blood-stained coughing and severe abdominal pain. The surface access point appeared through a maintenance shaft that connected to the Hive's atmospheric processing systems, though the final climb required ascending through a vertical tunnel filled with concentrated chemical vapors that represented the concentrated essence of Nostromo Secundus's toxic atmosphere. The climb was agony, each breath feeling like inhaling liquid fire, while the chemical burns on my hands made gripping the ladder rungs an exercise in controlled torture. The evidence remained secure in a waterproof container salvaged from the convoy, though the physical condition required to protect it was deteriorating rapidly. The emergence into the perpetual twilight of Nostromo's streets felt like resurrection, despite the fact that the surface atmosphere was only marginally less toxic than the conditions I had endured in the Underhive. The familiar sounds of the Manufactorum district provided orientation as I attempted to reach one of the few remaining safe houses that might have escaped enforcer attention, though the systematic nature of their operations made it likely that all known criminal refuges had been compromised. The shipping manifests represented evidence that could expose the entire conspiracy, but only if they could be transmitted to Imperial authorities who were not part of the corruption network. The Vox caster I had salvaged from an abandoned enforcer patrol vehicle provided the means to record my testimony, though the equipment had been damaged by chemical exposure and operated only intermittently. The transmission range was limited to local frequencies, making it unlikely that the recording would reach anyone with the authority to act on the evidence, but the attempt represented the only chance of ensuring that the conspiracy would eventually be exposed. The systematic elimination of witnesses had been thorough, but the shipping manifests provided documentary proof that could not be dismissed as the ravings of a dying criminal. The recording began as my strength failed and the chemical damage to my respiratory system made breathing increasingly difficult. The toxic atmosphere that had protected me from immediate capture was now claiming my life through progressive poisoning that manifested in organ failure and systemic breakdown. The evidence of the conspiracy would die with me unless the transmission reached someone with the capability and authority to act on the information, though the corruption network's reach made it likely that any investigation would be suppressed before it could threaten the archaeotech smuggling operations. The final testimony detailed everything I had discovered about the manipulation of gang warfare to serve the needs of corrupt officials who used criminal organizations as expendable assets in their larger schemes. The shipping manifests provided specific evidence of the conspiracy's scope, while the authorization codes could be traced to administrative offices throughout the Hive's power structure. The systematic nature of the gang eliminations had been designed to remove witnesses while providing distractions from the Archaeotech smuggling operations that generated profits beyond anything the criminal underworld had ever imagined. The Voxcaster's power supply failed as the chemical damage to my body reached the point where consciousness became intermittent, though the recording had captured enough information to expose the conspiracy if it ever reached the right authorities. The shipping manifests remained secured in their waterproof container, physical evidence that could corroborate the testimony if anyone ever discovered my body in the chemical waste facility where I had taken refuge. The perpetual darkness of Nostromo Secundus closed around me as the toxic atmosphere completed its work, leaving behind only the evidence of a conspiracy that had used the criminal underworld as pawns in games whose scope we had never comprehended. The silence that followed was broken only by the distant sounds of the Manufactorums continuing their endless production cycles, grinding out materials for an Imperium that would never know how its criminals had been manipulated by the very corruption it claimed to oppose. The evidence remained, waiting in the darkness for someone with the courage to act on what it revealed, though the systematic nature of the conspiracy made it likely that the truth would remain buried beneath the chemical waste of Nostromo Secundus until the Hive itself crumbled into the void.